We had an overview this morning about all the various different file systems in Linux and roughly what different options there are about these days. I'm going to be just talking purely about the ext3 file system in general. I'll also talk a little bit about some of the specific things that we've been working on in the virtual memory system that particularly affect journaling file systems and the work that we've been doing for example, things like allowing file systems to reserve memory in clean, deadlock-safe ways. But really, the bulk of the talk will be about this ext3 file system, and also about some of the implementation details, how the internals of the file system abstract out the journaling from the actual file system operations. Why have we done all this ext3 stuff anyway? Well, really there are several motivations. First of all, people still like ext2. They still trust ext2. ext2 is a fairly well-proven file system. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles of some of the newer file systems. It doesn't have the small file efficiency of RiserFS. It doesn't have the directory scalability of XFS, but it's a proven workhorse for Linux. And most importantly, there are rather a lot of Linux users out there who have got existing ext2 file systems, and more every day. And some of these ext2 file systems are getting really rather big. Even 24 months ago, there were people who were building 500 gigabyte ext2 file systems. They take a long time to FISC. I mean, really. These are file systems that can take 3 or 4 hours just to make FS. Doing a consistency check on them is a serious downtime. So the real objective in the ext3 was this simple thing, availability. When something goes down in ext3, we don't want to have to go through a FISC. We want to be able to reboot the machine instantly and have everything nice and consistent. And that's all it does. It's a minimal extension to the existing ext2 file system to add journaling. And it's really important. ext2 is the workhorse file system. It's the standard stable file system. We don't want to turn ext2 into an experimental file system. For one reason, users expect to have ext2 there as a demonstration of how to code file systems for Linux. It's a small, easily understood file system which demonstrates how to do all of the talking to the page cache, which has changed in 2.4, all of the locking in the directory handling that's changed in 2.4, all of these changes in the VFS interface and the VM interface that file systems have to deal with are showcased in the ext2. So there are multiple reasons why we really do not want to start making ext2 into an experimental file system, adding all sorts of new destabilizing features. And so the real goal for ext3 was to provide the minimal journaling, the minimal changes necessary to provide a complete journaling solution. So it provides scaling of the disk file system size because it allows you to make larger and larger file systems without the FISC penalty. But it's not designed to add things like very, very fast scalable directories to Linux, to ext2. It's not designed to provide extremely efficient support for extremely large files and extent map files and all this type of thing that people have been talking about for ext2. But really, the goal is to provide that one piece of functionality alone. And one of the most important goals for the whole project was to provide absolute, total, complete backwards and forwards compatibility between ext2 and ext3. You can take an existing ext2 file system, throw a journal file onto it, and mount it as ext3. There, you have a journaled file system. This laptop, I installed Red Hat 6.2 on it. It forwarded all these partitions as ext2. I added a couple of journal files, and now it's all running ext3. Better yet, if you unmount an ext3 file system, then it marks that file system as having been cleanly unmounted. The journal does not need to be recovered after a clean remount. So all these extra data structures that you get for journaling, for dealing with reboots, are not relevant if the file system has been unmounted cleanly. If you do a clean unmount of an ext3 file system, you can then mount it again as ext2. And ext2 just doesn't care. It's completely compatible in both directions. If you have an EXT3 file system after a crash, for example, and there's a journal on there which is active and which needs to be replayed onto the file system, then, well, in that particular case, you need to have recovery. You cannot mount it as EXT2 because to do so, you would get an inconsistent file system. You would corrupt all of the information that's in the journal. So EXT2 has for some time had a set of compatibility bits in the superblock which let you say, for example, what features are in the file system, so that versions of the kernel which don't understand a particular feature will not try to mount a file system that they can't understand. So if you've got an active EXT3 file system, there's a flag set in that superblock which says, don't you dare mount this as EXT2. It's not compatible. And EXT2 will cleanly... We'll be quite careful. I don't understand that bit. I'll refuse to mount it. But as soon as you've unmounted it, that bit gets cleared. Question there? Okay. And similarly, the FS progs, E2FS check, can use those bits to work out exactly whether or not this perfectly normal-looking EXT2 file system actually has an EXT3 journal, and whether or not that journal needs recovery. So we have complete compatibility, both in terms of the on-disk format, so that an unmounted EXT3 file system does look exactly like EXT2, but also in terms of the functionality. So all of the existing things that we have in EXT2, things like the persistent inode attributes, you can set set up an inode. For example, in EXT2, you can set a directory inode to be synchronous, so that all the updates in that file system have synchronous metadata updates. And that can be, you can set that attribute on a mail spool to get BSD synchronous update compatible behavior for your mail files. Things like sendmail can make assumptions about consistency after a reboot. And so if you need that kind of consistency, you can do that in EXT2. All those attributes are all exactly there in EXT3. Because the EXT3 source code started off by me just taking a copy of the entire EXT2 directory and copying it into a directory called EXT3, and then doing a global search and replace for all versions of EXT2, replacing that string with EXT3. It's exactly the same source base it started off from. The only reason it was made into a separate source tree was so that I could have test boxes that ran EXT3 development code on my test partition without having to run that same Delta development code in my root file system, which kind of made me a little bit nervous. I didn't want to do that. So we have EXT3 as a separate file system simply for that reason, to isolate the new code from the old stable code. But apart from that, I mean, it's exactly the same source base that's been used for the two. There's no loss of existing functionality. And in particular, the guarantee about journaling consistency covers all of the existing functionality. So even things like quotas are guaranteed to be consistent after a reboot with journaling. So if you update a file, write to an extend a file or truncate a file, the quota operations that go on alongside that operation are guaranteed to be consistent with the contents of the quota file. You never have to run a quota check after a reboot in EXT3, just as you never have to run a FISC. There are another couple of subtle issues around recovery which are really not at all handled at all, in any way whatsoever by existing file systems. The main one of these is orphaned files. And orphaned files is this concept that GFS people were talking about earlier as being a nasty case. That you can have files which are deleted from the file system, but which are still open by processes. And the semantics are that when that process dies, you want to delete the file, remove it from disk, return all the space to the file system. Well, that's all well and good. The trouble is that that file system state that has the file deleted but still open, that's a completely consistent state for the file system. So in the first versions of EXT3, if you have a file system in that state, well, it's perfectly consistent. The file, the unlink of that file was a single transaction on the disk. That transaction did not reclaim the disk space because it didn't need to. The file is still open. And so we've got this completely consistent on-disk state in which there is a file which exists on the disk but isn't in the directory structure anywhere. Now, obviously, after a reboot, you can be pretty sure that the reboot also kills a process that had that file open. And so we need to preserve the semantics that killing the process deletes the file. So we have to have some way of dealing with these orphaned files. And that's new functionality that we just don't have to deal with in EXT2, because EXT2 assumes that there's always a file system check there to clean up these things after a reboot. So we've actually got a few things like that in EXT3 that we need to deal with after a reboot to make sure that the consistency is complete. And so, really, this is the goal. It's absolute consistency of the file system in every respect after a reboot, with no loss of existing functionality. So, how is it actually implemented internally? What does this source look like? Well, as I say, the first thing we did was just take the ext2 file system and turn it into ext3. That's not the only new file system subdirectory that the ext3 patches provide. ext3 also provides a new subdirectory and file system directory on the Linux source tree called JFS. That's the journaling layer for ext3, and that's entirely independent of the ext3 file system itself. It's a completely abstract journaling layer which allows you to make arbitrary block device modifications in the buffer cache and have those obey transactional semantics. So you can make arbitrary transactions on arbitrary block devices, and file system transactions are just one example of things you can do with that. It was explicitly written so that, for example, if you had a logical volume manager which wants to make a number of changes over a number of different block devices and make those changes completely atomic with respect to reboot. So that, for example, you're adding a whole pile of logical volumes or deleting a pile of logical volumes and you're updating it across multiple block devices for a stripe set. The JFS layer that I added for this is perfectly capable of being used for something like that as well. It's not restricted to the ext3 file system. And in particular, the ext3 file system does not know anything about journaling. Journaling is separate. ext3 doesn't have the journaling. All it knows is transactions. It says, here is the beginning of a set of block device modifications. I'm going to modify this block device which contains my file system, and I'm going to tell you that these five block device updates form a single transaction. And it tells that to the journaling layer, and the journaling layer is responsible for making sure that those five updates either all appear in the block device after a reboot, or none of them appear. And the journaling is done inside that. ext3 does not know about journaling. The only places where ext3 has to interact with the journaling layer are to tell it where these transactions start and stop, and which updates belong to which transaction. And also to manage the disk space that's used by the inode which contains the journal. And the journal in the JFS layer can be on any inode in any file system, or it can be on an arbitrary subrange, set of contiguous blocks on any block device. It doesn't even have to be on the same device that your file system is on. And you can have multiple file systems sharing the same journal if you want. The JFS layer will cope with all of that. The only things that we have to do is manage the transactions and manage the journal inode. And one of the things involved in that is that the file system is responsible for asking the journal layer to do journal recovery after an unclean reboot. And as I said earlier, once you've done all that, once you've unwinded the thing, the ext3 file system tells the journaling to close down and clean up the journal and mark everything as consistent. And once it's done that, and the journaling layer has said, fine, all of your updates are consistent on this, the journal has been emptied out, the file system can then just set a flag in the file system that says, okay, we no longer need recovery in this thing, don't worry about the journal, and just feel free to mount it as ext2. So that's basically what we have in the design. It's two completely different sets of code, one this abstract journaling layer, and one a simple set of modifications to ext3 to add transactions. So if we look at this layer that's adding journaling, what does it look like? What does it provide? Well, what it does is it exports an API which allows you to add transactions on any block device. So just as ext3 doesn't understand the first thing about journaling, it doesn't need to. The JFS layer doesn't understand the first thing about file systems, it doesn't need to. All of the file system properties are dealt with inside ext3, all of the journaling is done inside the JFS layer. It provides an abstract concept of a log. It allows you to register a journal with the JFS layer. And when you register that journal, you've got two choices. You can either say, here is some inode on some file system. Please use the contents of this inode as a journal. That must be the block device file system because the JFS layer assumes that it can always do a mapping between an arbitrary block inside that inode and a block on disk. So it says that create one of these journals, either in an inode or on a block device. It doesn't care which you use. And it doesn't even have, you don't even have to have the journal on the same device that you're going to be doing the updates on. So you can have a file system over here and journal it to a separate spool disk over there if you want to. The JFS layer will be quite happy with that. In fact, you can even have more than one block device journaling to the same disk if you want. The JFS layer is quite happy about that. It provides write ordering guarantees all the way through the I.O. layers in the kernel. So it makes all these guarantees that if you have a transaction which is in progress and but has not yet been committed, the JFS layer provides a guarantee that not one update of that particular transaction will hit the main disk until you've done the commit. It provides that, provides all of that guarantee, but it doesn't necessarily tell you when the updates will hit disk. The JFS's updates are still right behind. So in other words, you're not doing transactions synchronously. You're not saying, well, I'll do all of these updates and that results in the creation of a new directory on the disk. And all of the updates that I've made to the disk are then committed into the journal and then I return. The JFS layer maintains in cache a list of all of the updates which form any particular transaction, and it will do in its own sweet time the normal write behind that the buffer layer is already doing Linux. It will just write behind in some future time, will make sure that all those updates hit the disk, but it will make guarantees about the ordering so that when they do hit disk, the transaction is either all there or not there at all. Now, journaling in many cases is very similar to file system of, sorry, to databases. Sorry, there's a question, Peter. The question is there ordering guarantees in the JFS layer? Yes and no. This is actually a reasonably complicated design issue. And it's something which in particular makes a huge amount of difference whether you're running on a single disk file system, sorry, a single node file system or a shared disk. It's one of the reasons the GFS implements things very differently internally to EXT3. The JFS layer in EXT3, its API does not make any guarantees about transaction ordering. If you have a transaction which updates blocks 1, 2, and 3 on disk, and another one that updates blocks 5, 6, and 7, the API doesn't give you any ordering guarantee about between those. Now, on something like GFS, if it's doing journaling, that's really important that there's no ordering guarantee. Because in GFS, you've got to be able to release a disk block back to disk as quickly as possible in order to relinquish a lock, and which is required by some other node. On a local disk file system, you don't have that. So on a local disk file system, it's quite legitimate to batch all these updates off into very large transactions and just send them out all at once. That works really efficiently. The only place where it breaks down on a local disk is if you've got synchronous updates. If you do, for example, an fsync on a file, or open a file as osync. And in that case, if you have absolute write ordering guarantees, then in order to flush this one little file out to disk, say it's a mail spool and you're doing an fsync on some file that's just arrived in off the network, in order to sync that to disk, if you've got write ordering guarantees, then you've got to sync all of the previous transactions and commit them to disk as well. And that's expensive, because that hurts the latency of those syncs. It does not change your bandwidth. It's actually more efficient in terms of disk bandwidth and throughput to batch the transactions up in large chunks. So the API that JFS exports does not make any guarantees about write ordering consistency. Internally, it batches all of the updates that are made by the file system. It just batches them up sequentially into big compound transactions and puts them out to disk as a single unit. So the implementation does actually happen to preserve write ordering in all cases. That is not guaranteed by the API, and one of the things that we need to do once the core is out there and being used once everything is up and running, including all the performance stuff that's still a work in progress, is to do profiling to find out whether or not there are applications which really do need to have fine-grained committing of transactions. So that when you async, you just, you know, you've got transactions 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and transaction 6 suddenly becomes related to an async, and you have to commit that one. Does it actually make a difference for performance to be able to do a commit of transaction 6 without committing transactions 3 to 5? If that turns out to be the case, then I will be able to do that in the future without changing the API. The API doesn't make that guarantee. It's just an optimization internally. But apart from that, all the right ordering guarantees are made. And how it does this is fairly simple. Journaling file systems are in most cases very closely related to database journaling, but with some very, very special cases. In databases, typically a logging database is characterized by the steps it has to go through to recover the state of the database after a crash. And it's characterized by whether you have to do undos or redos. So in the case of an undo logging, that means that what you do is that you put into the journal all of the old state of the buffers that you're modifying, and then you can write the new state to the disk. And if you crash before the transaction is committed, then you can undo the modification you made on disk by copying the old contents from the log, so that the log contains the information necessary to undo incomplete transactions. Or you can do redo logging, which is that the new data is written into the log, and you leave the original data on disk in its main location. And then after a crash, any transactions which are incomplete, the original copy is still on disk, so you don't have to do anything. And it's only complete transactions which exist in the log, and you have to replay those into the main file system. In almost all cases, journaling file systems just use a simple case of doing redo logging. So basically, every single modification that's made to the file system will be written to the log first, and only once it's committed in the log. Not just written to the log, but committed in the log, are we allowed to update the main copy on disk. And that's what EXT2 does, sorry, EXT3 does. And all of those write ordering guarantees are provided by the JFS layer. So that JFS layer controls these various different things. It controls transaction commit, and the commit of a transaction involves writing all of the things which that transaction modified to the journal, and then writing a commit record. It's not sufficient just to write the thing to the journal, because there's got to be some mark in the journal which says, well, does this journal record actually represent a complete consistent state of the disk? And the way that you do that is by having some atomic operation which marks that transaction as being complete on disk. Now, disks these days actually make these guarantees. If you start a write operation to a disk, then even if the power fails in the middle of that sector write, the disk has enough power available, and it can actually steal power from the rotational energy of the spindle. It has enough power to complete the write of the sector that's being written right now. In all cases, the disks make that guarantee. So the fundamental thing about transactions are, at the end of writing the new contents of the transaction to the log, we write a single 512-byte sector to the disk, which contains whatever magic numbers to identify it as a particular type of block, that say this is a commit block, and it will contain a sequence number that matches all the transactions that's gone previously, so that it doesn't get confused between what you've been writing there and the old contents of the log previously. That single write of that one sector on disk marks the entire transaction as being complete. And so all of that write ordering, the write ordering within the journal that says that the journal has to be written and complete on disk before you write the commit record, that's all handled by JFS. The write ordering that says you have to write the commit record before you can write any of the blocks back to the main file system, that's all handled by the JFS. Obviously, there's only a limited amount of space in that log. So the old transaction checkpointing. Checkpointing is the process of flushing all of the contents of the log out to the main disk. That's handled by the DFS layer, and that's actually really, really important. Because if you think about it, the transaction is committed on disk as soon as we've written that commit record in the log. But once that commit record has been written to the log, the only copy of the data that the transaction has just written is in the log. The main copy to the disk, the main copy on disk still has the old version. So we cannot throw away that data in the log until we have written it, copied it back onto disk. And that's called checkpointing. That's what allows us to reuse bits of the log. We take the contents of the log, make sure that the copies on disk are all up to date, and at that point we can trim the tail of the log. All of that's handled by the JFS layer. All of the write behind is handled by the JFS layer. It has its own sets of timeouts. It links itself into the buffer cache write behind layers. So all of that's handled completely transparently to the file system. And also, the JFS layer, for performance reasons, tries to make everything go as asynchronously as possible. It never stalls things, it never tries to do more copies than it needs to. So, for example, when we're doing journaling, the file system may say, okay, take some buffer that's in memory, I'm going to write this to disk at that location there, and please journal it. And the journaling code has to make sure that that block gets written to the journal first, and then after the commit, it goes to its main location on disk. And the journaling layer will do zero copy from that. It will actually create a new I/O request that points to the old disk buffer location and use that to journal the data to the journal file without copying the data block. So all of that kind of thing is handled by the JFS layer. There was a question. The question is, does it make sense under extreme memory pressure to throw away data that's been written to the journal but hasn't yet been written to disk? Absolutely no, because if it's written into the journal and you want to throw it away, it's much, much more efficient just to write it to disk than doing anything else. On the next slides, I'll talk about reservations, which are the way that you limit the amount of outstanding data that's being used by the transaction layer at any point in time. And that reservation system is sufficient to reduce the memory pressure. Was there a question here?
Yeah, actually, too, one earlier was about performance. The question was secure atomicity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the disks guarantee secure atomicity for like 5-4 byte blocks.
Yes.
And normally file systems are using much larger chunks for that.
Right. Question?
The disks also do not guarantee the order that they write those blocks out.
No. So two questions. First of all, the block size, the sector size that the disk is guaranteed to be atomic is smaller than the sector size that the block size the file system uses. Yes, but for the commit block, I only ever care about the first 512 bytes of that block. If the commit block's first 512 bytes are up to date on disk, then that is assumed to mean that the entire transaction is committed. And you have to be very, very careful not to have critical commit information that spans a 512 byte sector boundary. So that's okay. As for write ordering, absolutely. We need to make sure that even when we submit multiple async I/O requests to the disk doesn't allow us to reorder things in such a way that the commit block hits the disk before the other transaction blocks. And I will come back to that point because it's actually a really nasty point for performance. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
Yes. One other thing that I'll say about this in terms of asynchronous behaviour is that the journaling layer is really careful. I'll come back. The journaling layer is really careful to make sure that things don't stall unnecessarily. So that means that when we start committing a transaction, we don't stall the file system itself. And committing a transaction means that we take, okay, I am going to take a snapshot of the entire file system state at this point in time, and I will start committing that state to disk. But the file system is still allowed to make new copies of the data. The file system is still allowed to modify the block device, the virtual block device in the buffer cache. While it does that, we have to keep the old contents of that snapshot present in memory so that we can commit it to disk. And so that, in that particular case, the JFS layer provides a copy-on-write mechanism so that if a new file system request comes along, that wants to modify a block that we are in the process of committing but have not yet finished committing, then we make a copy of that before the file system is allowed to modify the buffer. And that means that the disk I/O for committing a previous transaction can go on in parallel with the file system operations for the new transaction. It's just one of the things that we do in the JFS layer to really make sure that the concurrency of the system is as high as possible. There are no synchronous transactions in the JFS layer at all. The only way you can get something synchronous is if you say, well, I actually want the file system, the application, to wait until this thing is on disk because the application has done something like an fsync. So JFS provides all this functionality, and it provides it to the user, where in this case the user is something like the LVM layer, or in this case the ext3 layer. And it has a nice abstract API for exporting this functionality. Everything is expressed in terms not of transactions but of handles, and we make this distinction clear. A handle represents one single operation that marks a consistent set of updates in the disk. So a handle might be something like a create. And the create has to go through a directory, add a directory entry to a directory, modify the timestamp on that directory, modify the size of the directory. It has to allocate a new inode. It has to then modify the inode table for that. It has to modify the superblock to change the number of inodes in that group marked in the superblock, and it has to mark the inode bitmap as being changed. And all of these operations for a single consistent operation, update in the file system, are done with a single handle. But a handle is not necessarily the same thing as the journaling transaction on disk, because the journaling layer will allow multiple updates like this to be batched into a single transaction. So we make this distinction quite clear, that a transaction on the disk is not necessarily the same as the handles, the updates that the file system is doing. And that means that because we're doing write behind, we're maybe only making one file system commit every 5 seconds, and you can have hundreds and hundreds of file system operations proceeding within that timescale. So everything can be just batched up very efficiently using these handles. Now, the API has a journal start and a journal stop pair. A journal start gives you a handle, journal stop tells the system that handle is finished with. It provides nested transactions, so if you do a journal start and then another journal start, that all gets batched into the same transaction. And the handle is not marked as complete until you've gone through two journal stops in that case. When you do that journal start, you have to tell the JFS layer how many blocks you expect might be modified by this update. And that's really, really important. This is absolutely critical to avoid deadlocking in the journal. The JFS layer has to know before it starts committing your transaction, before it starts processing your transaction, that there is enough space left in the journal to write out all of the blocks which might become part of your transaction. And if it turns out there's not enough log space left, well, it might be that your transaction includes blocks from previous transactions in the journal. And because these blocks are now being pinned as part of a new transaction, we can't flush them to disk. And because we can't flush them to disk, we can't checkpoint the log to remove one of the old transactions from the log. And because we can't do that, we've run out of space, we've just deadlocked completely. So we have to make these kind of reservations to make sure that the transaction does not start until all of the space that it might use is guaranteed present in the log. So the journal start, journal stop provide boundaries to make those kind of reservation guarantees. There's a question at the back. What happens if you run into... question is, what happens if there's just not enough space physically in the journal for the transaction? Transactions are very limited in size. They're never more than a few dozen blocks. The only two cases where a transaction can grow without bounds are for write system calls, because a write can actually... An application can quite legitimately write a half gigabyte of memory to a file in one syscall. But that's okay, because the ESDC does not guarantee that that write is atomic. It has to be broken up into smaller transactions. And the only other case is truncate, because you might have a 10 gigabyte file that you're deleting, and you really want that delete to be an atomic operation, but that delete can touch arbitrary amounts of disk space. Potentially, you have one separate bitmap block. If you're in the most fragmented case in the file system, you could have a separate bitmap block being updated on the disk for every single block that you free from that file. So truncates are a special case, which I'll come to later because we have to deal with that in a nasty manner. Ask any of the journaling file system people in the audience what's the heaviest part of the entire system, and it's deleting files. It's everything to do with delete is hairy. Everything to do with delete, you have nightmares around what happens if blocks get deleted and then reallocated, and what happens if they get reallocated as a different type of data, what happens if you reallocate them and then take a crash and have to undo the reallocation and undo the delete operation, and they really get nasty. So most of the problems in EXT3, most of the really hairy parts of the design, as in most journaling file systems, in fact, come from deletes. So all of the block device updates that the file system makes after this time go through a pair of journaling calls exported by the GFS. You can ask the journal to give you write access to a block. And remember I said earlier that to ensure efficiency in the system, we do copy on write. If there's a block being scheduled for commit, then we don't mind the file system continuing to modify that block as long as we have a chance to copy it out and make sure that the old snapshot that we're committing is still consistent. And to achieve that copy on write, we have to know what the file system is going to modify before it modifies it. So we have to go through a process of getting permission to write to a block just to make sure that the copy on write can happen. And then at the end of it, we can say, okay, that block has now been finished, it's now been dirtied, it can now be written to the journal or whatever. So this API provides the reservation, it provides the handles that you get back from this journaling, you can mark individual handles as being synchronous before the journal stop. And when the final journal stop happens and that transaction is bundled up for the current transaction on disk, it will immediately submit that commit to the disk and will synchronously wait for that commit to finish on disk before returning. So you can get synchronous operation on a per handle basis. And it also provides the GFS layer provides various kind of management functions for creating a journal, doing recovery in a journal, marking a journal as being complete, flushing journal out to disk and so on, things like that. You need that inside EXT3. For example, if EXT3 file system that's read-write gets mounted read-only, if you remount it read-only, you want to make sure that beyond that point, no more updates happen to the file system. You want to make sure that nothing else happens on the journal. You also want to make sure that there is no recovery necessary on that file system if you take a reboot while the file system is marked read-only. So all of the consistency functions necessary to flush everything out and stop further write when you get one of these remounts, all of those kind of functions are exported by the GFS layer. The important thing about this API is that all of the updates that we're making are expressed in terms of, here is a block, here's the new contents of that buffer on disk. We're doing physical journaling. Now, there are some file systems that do journaling which do logical journaling, and that means that, for example, if they allocate a particular disk block to a particular file, they'll write an entry in the journal that says, this disk block is marked free, is marked in use, and this file has a mapping pointer to that disk block. And that description for that allocation might only be a few bytes long. EXTC will journal the entire copy of the blocks that have been modified, all 1K, 4K, whatever, of the blocks. But it doesn't do any copy when it's doing that, so the CPU overhead is minimal. And in particular, if you have got a lot of operations that touch the same blocks, that block only gets journaled once. And that means that this is a very, very simple mechanism which gives you completely free compression of multiple events. So, for example, you almost never get a disk block allocated in a single commit operation. If the commits are going every 5 seconds, then, well, if you only had one block allocated within that 5-second boundary, then it's no big deal to write out 4K to mark that block in use. But as is more likely, you've got hundreds and hundreds of allocations going in rapid succession. All of the bitmap blocks, all the bits in the bitmaps which are being updated, only result in one copy of the new block being sent to disk. So it's actually a fairly efficient way of compressing these kind of multiple operations, multiple directory operations or multiple allocations within a single block group. They can all be compressed fairly efficiently down to the disk. There are different types of buffer that you can pass through into the JFS layer. Now, this is getting into the issue about, are we journaling every operation on the disk, or are we only journaling metadata? Now, right now, the current version of EXT3 that's in public release, EXT3 is journaling all metadata. It's journaling metadata and data. So every file that you write is being written twice. It's being written once to the log and once to the main disk. The design goal is obviously not to do that. So the design is that you can have metadata being journaled, but the data itself just gets written back to the disk any old way. Now, if you do that, there are a whole pile of new ordering constraints come in. And guess what? They're all to do with delete, except for one. The only one that doesn't have to do with delete is what happens if you allocate a whole pile of data, write it to disk, and then take a crash. Well, if you take a crash and then recover the state of that journal and replay all the allocations to disk, but the data has not yet been written to disk, then the user can read those disk blocks and they'll get old, stale contents of what was previously there on the disk. And that might be an old copy of Etsy password or some other file that you don't really want the user poking around in. So for security, you really want to make sure that newly allocated data blocks will get flushed to the disk before the transaction which allocates them is allowed to commit. So we have this concept of data blocks, and that write ordering guarantee for data blocks is preserved by the JFS layer. Then there are a whole pile of other things that can go wrong. I can have a directory which is deleted. I can delete a directory. That's a perfectly legitimate operation in EXT2. And I can do that, and I can commit that delete to disk. And then I can have a new transaction which reallocates those same data blocks, which are now free, and puts them into a file. And I can commit that. And everything's now consistent, except what happens if I take a reboot? Well, what happens is that we do a reboot, and the log gets replayed. And we go through the journal, replaying all the metadata blocks which are in that log. And, this directory that we deleted, a few transactions back, we made a new entry in that directory, and there's a metadata block for that directory entry on the journal. But we don't journal data, so the new contents of that data block, which are on the main disk, aren't in the journal. And so we take a crash and we replay and we overwrite that data block with the old contents of the directory block, because that's all that's in the journal. This is generally considered bad behaviour. So we need to have ways of dealing with that. So we need to be able to have revoke records. There are various different ways of dealing with this. You can deal with it by making certain delete operations synchronous. You can do it by making sure that you don't reuse disk blocks until you've checkpointed that old record out of the journal. The way we're doing that in the EXT3 is that deleting metadata can cause a revoke record to be written into the journal. And when you do the replay of the journal, the first thing, in the very first pass of the journal recovery, we look for all the revoke records and make sure that any data that's been revoked is never ever replayed. And so that deals with that particular case. There are much worse things that can happen in journaling with deletes. For example, what happens if you have a piece of metadata that's in your directory and you've deleted that and then you've reallocated it as data? And because you're reallocating it as data, well, we have this property that we flush all the data to the disk before we commit the transaction. So we flush this data to the disk, and then before we've committed the transaction, we take a power failure, and we have to reboot, and we do the log recovery. And guess what? The operation which deleted that directory wasn't committed, so we've revoked that delete. So we've basically undeleted that directory. Unfortunately, actually, we had thought we were going to reallocate that directory as data, and we've already flushed the data to disk and overwritten the directory that we've actually just had to undelete and whoops. So we have to make sure that we avoid that kind of thing. And there are, again, various ways of doing that. the way that this works in EXT3 is that the journaling layer provides the file system with the ability to record the last committed state of the bitmap block. And the file system can then use that to make sure that when it is allocating data, it never ever reuses a data block that has been freed in the bitmaps, but that freeing hasn't yet been committed. So there are all these little tricky things that happen around delete, and all of the write ordering constraints. The JFS layer has enough infrastructure in there to support the file system for getting this thing right. But the JFS layer doesn't understand anything about the difference between these different types of data. It just has ordering guarantees which the file system can use to make sure that data, that metadata-only journaling does actually work right. That is all actually implemented, but the current EXTC doesn't use it. It's not enabled for the simple reason that these write ordering constraints are really tricky to get right, and the priority has been to make sure that the core rest of the EXTC code is rock solid before we start introducing all these weird and wonderful new bits and pieces. A few other things that we have in the JFS layer there. It supports nested transactions. Now, this is what I was saying earlier, that if you have a journal start and you get another operation which does a journal start, well, you can do that quite happily. The nested transactions allow you... this was really implemented for COSA files. Now, if anyone's familiar with the Linux VFS layer, they realize the quota system that EXT2 uses is not inside the EXT2 file system. It's actually a generic quota utility layer in the Linux VFS. And the Linux VFS exports functions that the file system can use. So the file system can say, okay, I've allocated a disk block. Please update this quota record accordingly. And the Linux VFS will say, okay, fine, there's enough quota left for you to do that, that's quite legal, please go ahead with that, and I'll make sure that the appropriate quota record on some arbitrary file is updated. And as far as the VFS layer is concerned, the quota is just a regular file, and it makes write calls to the file system to update the quota file. Now, if you want to make quota updates consistent with the rest of the transactions, you actually need those write calls that the VFS is making to be part of the same transaction that the allocation on disk was part of. You have to make sure that they're consistent. You have to make sure that the quota file update is always part of the same transaction as the allocation that's doing that, that's modifying it. And by using nested transactions, this just comes for free. The write system call starts a transaction. It calls the quota layer does another write. That new write for the quota file starts a transaction, but it gets a nested transaction inside the first one, modifies the quota file, completes out of that, and only when the whole operation is finished do we mark that as being a complete transaction on the disk. So this quota file stuff just came for free. And it turns out that this is actually quite useful. There are applications out there that want to be able to use nested transactions in the file system. And one in particular that's already using this is the Intermezzo file system that Ted talked about earlier. It's a distributed file system that has a local disk cache for caching files on a hard disk locally. And there's a coherency protocol that the various different nodes in this Intermezzo loose network use to communicate with each other to say, okay, I've got a newer copy of this particular file, I'll propagate it to all the other servers. I'm about to modify this copy of the file, so I'm going to invalidate the server's copies. All that type of thing. Intermezzo supports disconnected operation. If I have populated my local disk cache with copies of the main servers in Intermezzo, then I can put that on my laptop, take it away, go out to this conference, have all my email on that, have all my editor stuff on that, and when I get back home, I can plug it back into the network and everything gets replayed. The disconnected operation is really powerful. But that means that the local disk cache, there has to be a way of recording what has changed in the local disk cache so that when we do reconnect to the rest of the network, we can replay what's changed. And Intermezzo actually uses EXT3 for this to get very, very high performance in the local disk cache. Because it creates a nested transaction, and say I'm running a disconnected operation and I'm making a new file on my file system. Intermezzo will create that new file in its disk cache, and will update a journal file that Intermezzo maintains to say this inode over here has been created in the Intermezzo file system with such and such a file name, and it belongs to this particular place in the cache. And Intermezzo really wants to make sure that the contents of its log, of its replay log, match what's actually on the file system cache. And it can use EXTC for that. It can use a nested transaction. It will start a nested transaction, create the file, write an update record to its replay log saying that that file has been created. And it gets normal write behind, so there's no synchronous updates on disk. It's fully asynchronous write behind performance to that local disk cache, but after a crash, it guarantees that that replay log is exactly consistent with the actual state of the disk cache. So Intermezzo is using these nested transactions. It's proven very, very useful for them. Now we get to some of these other awkward little things. Orphan files, as I said earlier. If we have a file which has been unlinked on disk, but which is still open, then on a reboot, we need to make sure that that file is deleted. So EXT3 adds a new data structure on the disk. It just has has an entry in the superblock, which points to a linked list of inodes on disk which need to be deleted on reboot. And whenever you unlink an open file, it gets added onto that list. And when you finally close that file, the delete operation which happens as a result of that close will remove the inodes from that list. I said earlier that truncate operations also can have unbounded transaction sizes. Well, that's okay. If you get a truncate operation which exhausts the size of the journal, then that truncate will be split up into more than one transaction. But we still guarantee that that's atomic over a reboot. Because if we have to split up one of these truncates over multiple transactions, we put it on exactly the same orphan file list. And so in recovery, we can do all the cleanup. It basically means that when we do a recovery, we look at the number of links, the number of hard links to that file in the inode list. And if the number of links is zero, we know it's a file that's just been deleted, and we delete it. We finish doing the delete. If the number of links is greater than zero, we know it must have been in the middle of a truncate, and so we complete the truncate operation. So all of that kind of gets done at the EXTC level. That cannot be done inside the journaling level. VM reservations, we have... journaling has this unfortunate property that if you've got a transaction that's in progress, you cannot free the memory that transaction is occupying without first allowing the transaction to complete. Because unlike databases, most file systems do not implement transaction aborts. It's just not... It's just not something which is normally needed in the file system. And if you're not going to be able to abort a transaction, then you have to let the transactions run to completion. And if we're going to let the transactions run to completion, then we have to have enough memory to do that. And if the VM system is saying, well, I can't give you any more memory right now until you give me back some, then you can deadlock very, very rapidly. So we need to have a way of doing VM virtual memory transaction reservations, sorry, page reservations, so that the file system doesn't use more memory than the VM layer is able to give back independently. And it turns out that this is actually a relatively trivial thing to add to the EXT3 file system, because journaling file systems already need to do the same kind of reservation in the log. So one of the things that the VM developers and the journaling file system developers have been talking about recently is how to add an API to the virtual memory layer which allows the file systems to tell the VM about the reservations it's making and to make sure that we never run into these deadlock situations. There are also some tricky corners about write pressure. For example, if you've filled too much memory with dirty data, and it's proving impossible to clear stuff out of memory because all of the pages in memory are dirty and need to be written to disk first, then we need to, at that point, stop making more dirty data. We also need to start cleaning the existing dirty pages back to disk. Now, the file system has its own write ordering constraints. It cannot let the VM arbitrarily decide to write these things back to disk. But the VM is the only part of the system that knows when this write pressure is getting excessive. So we have to have callbacks into the journaling file system, which let the VM say, well, you've got all these dirty pages, I want to start writing them back. But the file system's got to be able to say, well, actually, these dirty pages are pinned in memory because of transactions, but I've got pages over here that I can free. So we want to have callbacks from the virtual memory system into the file system, purely advisory callbacks, so that the VM can say, I have found all these dirty pages which I want you to get rid of. But if you can't do it, I don't care as long as you find something to get rid of. And at that, once you've got that kind of advisory callback, dumb naive file systems like FAT or EXT2 can just say to the VM, okay, you told me to write this page back, I'll do it. more advanced file systems that do journaling can use that as an indication that we need to do some write pressure and can choose the most appropriate pages to get rid of because they know what the write ordering constraints are. So all of these little tricks that we need to do between the VM and the VFS, hopefully we'll get a lot of that in before 2.4 is released. And that will allow the clean merging of a whole class of different journals file systems that have exactly the same ordering constraints that the VM isn't aware of right now. And then finally we've got this write ordering constraint at the SCSI level, which our man in the front was talking about. Right now, the only way that we can do commits safely is by waiting for the disk to tell us that the entire transaction has hit disk, and only then will you give the commit block to the disk.
You mean that it's on media?
On media, absolutely, yes. Well, if the disk has got write behind battery-backed cache, then that's fine. We don't care as long as it's made persistent. As long as the log updates have been made persistent, then we can allow the commit block to go to disk. But it turns out that SCSI has a very nice feature called tagged command queuing. You can have a whole pile of disk operations, disk writes outstanding on the disk at once, and the disk can do them in any order it cares. And it will just tell you that it's finished in whatever order it happens to choose. There is a bit in the SCSI command called, is it, ordered tag. You can actually set an ordered tag bit on the tagged command queue, and that is a write barrier to the SCSI layer. The SCSI layer will guarantee, the SCSI disk will guarantee that no writes that occurred that you submitted before that ordered operation will overtake it, and that no writes submitted after it will be sent to disk before that operation. And if we have in the block device I/O layer, if we have a way of specifying that barrier operation, say this is a commit block, don't reorder this block, reorder anything on either side of it, but don't reorder this one. If we can set that in the block device layer so that the Linux internal device reordering queues and the disk's reordering queues all observe and honour that barrier operation, then we can keep the pipeline going to the disk, streaming the data to the disk at full speed without waiting synchronously for the completion of these transactions. And that becomes really important for a few special cases. That becomes really important if you're synchronously committing a lot of fast transactions to disk. And there are cases where that really happens. Mail spools and NFS servers, the two canonical examples. Mail spools are constantly updating lots of small files, and they want to do an fsync after each one to make sure that they don't tell the sender that the mail has been received until the disk has recorded the fact that it's safe on disk. And in the case of NFS, NFS v2 or v1 servers are expected not to acknowledge the write to disk until it's safe on disk. Because the whole point of NFS recovery is that if the server crashes, the client will replay any of the commands that weren't acknowledged by the server. But anything that was acknowledged by the server is assumed to be safe on disk. And therefore, the server, if that's to work over a server crash, the server can't acknowledge the NFS commands until it's safe on disk, which means that the NFS server is typically doing large numbers of very, very small data writes synchronously. And in EXT3, we want to be able to have those writes spooling sequentially to a separate disk, which is the journal disk. Remember that the journal will not necessarily have to be on the same disk as the file system. So we want to be able to just spool the stuff sequentially onto a journal disk at full speed. And having to wait for all of the log to be written before you submit the commit request, the commit I/O, typically means that you're wasting a whole rotational latency in the disk whenever you're doing a commit. If we can get these write barriers right through the Linux I/O layers, that really, really improves the performance of these streaming synchronous I/Os. That's one thing that's on the cards. It will probably not get into 2.4, but the I/O layers in Linux will hopefully have this in 2.5. Another question here?
Well, just a comment. I mean, you're assuming that the write ordering implementation of the firmware on the disk actually is functional.
I'm assuming that the write ordering on the firmware of the disk is functional, correct. I assume that when the disk says that it's written something, oh, I know. We will only enable this with either a whitelist or a blacklisted set of drives. We already got drive blacklists in the kernel for things that lie hideously. So, absolutely, that will not be a default behavior. We have to be very careful about that. So, the status on this, the Core EXE3 is, the one that I'm running on the laptop here, is absolutely robust. There are no known problems in that. Some of the kind of user interface issues are not quite 100%. If you delete the journal or if you give it an invalid journal inode or things like that, then the actual setup of the journaling can sometimes get a bit confused. But those are management issues surrounding the user-level tools which are being used to manage that. The user-level tools is the main thing that we're working on right now, and the metadata-only journaling. The actual core file system is rock solid. It's being used in production web FTP servers for multiple tens of gigabyte file systems. I trust it absolutely with the laptop here, and given the status of some of the device drivers that have been running on this laptop recently, it's rather convenient to have the ability to reboot very, very quickly. The E2FS progs has, at the minute, it's minimal support for E2FS for EXT3, but it is there. It will understand the presence of the recovery bits and the journal bits and will do appropriate things, at least in as much as it will not touch a file system that it doesn't know how to touch, and it will not complain about the existence of a journal if the journal happens to be there but doesn't need recovery. So there is ongoing work for things like the metadata-only journaling. As I say, the infrastructure in the JFS for that is all implemented except for the revoke records. The current superblock format, the journal format, does not have revoke records, but that's the only thing needing to be added before I can actually enable all of that support. The quota stuff is in there. It has not been fully tested. I know that there are people using it, but it's not tested as much as the rest of the code, so I need to have more testing done on that before I recommend it as being stable. E2FS progs, E2FS check, we already have prototype code in E2FS progs, E2FS check in a development branch for doing log replay. The one thing that's missing from that right now is the replay of the orphan lists. Once that's all done, we will have a fully functioning E2FS check, which won't require any kernel support. There are a couple of other things that are being worked on. For example, I'm going to be moving the journal from being a regular file to being a reserved file and have a tune2fs function which will allow you to add an arbitrary-sized journal inode to an existing EXT2 file system without it appearing in the file system namespace, and therefore without it tempting people to delete it and nasty things like that. That's basically where we're at right now. The current core EXT3 is stable. It does journal data, and therefore it has poor write performance for write-intensive operations. But it is reliable, and it will run, it can be added transparently to any existing EXT2 file system. That will be maintained as a stable branch while I'm merging in the metadata-only journaling. So there will be a development branch. This is all 2.2. 2.4 the 2.4 port will only happen once all of this is stable, because it's not possible to achieve a sufficiently high level of reliability if you're changing too many things at one time. It just makes it so much harder to maintain and debug. There are some things which I'm leaving until after the first complete stable release, and that is in particular, although the JFS layer understands off-disk journaling and understands about multiple block devices sharing the same journal, there are a number of really nasty management issues in terms of administration of that kind of environment. Like, what happens if you've got 10 file systems sharing the same off-disk journal, and on reboot one of those file systems dies? Well, you can't actually start reusing the contents of your journal until you've done all the recovery. And you can't do all of the recovery until you've got all the file systems mounted, or at least finished, at least until you find all the file systems that use that journal. And if one of those file systems has disappeared, you can't do recovery onto that file system, therefore you can't start reusing the journal. Therefore, all the other file systems which are sharing the same journal go south. So it's a little problem. We have to do things like making sure that the recovery code has the ability to untangle the different bits of the journal into a separate file and store that in the temp directory somewhere, so that when that missing file system gets found later on, we can do the recovery then. There are all sorts of little things like that we have to deal with when we've got off-disk journals and shared journals, which just don't ever come into the picture if we're journaling on the same device that the file system's on. So that will probably be a post 1.0 issue. And one other thing that I want to do is to actually export the Nesto Transaction API into user space. You have to be very, very careful about that because it's not possible to guarantee proper database semantics. You can't have unbounded large transactions. You have to have some way that in which the user application can get in advance some idea of how many disk blocks it's going to need to modify for the operations it's going to call. Various things like that, which are not entirely straightforward. It's not quite as simple as people would hope, but it's sufficiently useful that will be exported to the user space at some point. That's almost all for EXTC. EXTC is not the only thing that's going on with EXT2. There are other things that are happening in the EXT2 file system space as separate development branches, much like EXT3 is a development branch of EXT2. And it's likely that some number of these will be merged into a single new EXT2 variant sometime in the future. There are people increasingly hammering for security support. Access control lists, mandatory access control labels, capabilities, all that type of thing. There are people who really want that in Linux. There are proposals from the US Department of Defense that will forbid them from purchasing any operating system that does not have these facilities, these capabilities. And they have been trying to persuade the US government to adopt the same rules, although they are resisting that. There's B-tree support. B-trees are fairly complicated on disk structures. There are people who want to have B-tree support in EXT2 for scalable directory performance, but B-trees can go really horribly haywire if you interrupt them in the middle of a pre-balancing operation. And so making them consistent over reboot either requires that you're very, very careful and do lots of extra I.O. on the on-disk structure to make sure that it can be recovered sanely, or you do journaling. In fact, there's a whole section of code inside RiserFS which was dealing with exactly this issue, which has basically had been eliminated from the file system now that they've got journaling, because journaling deals with all that for them. For EXT3, putting in B-trees into EXT3 really requires JFS as a prerequisite. Online resize is being done for EXT2. And there are a few other minimally intrusive extensions that EXT2 has this advantage of being a very nice, simple file system. And you can do B-tree extent maps inside your files as a very efficient way of encoding large files in your disk. Now, you don't actually have to use B-trees for that. If you don't use B-trees, you can just have a very simple extent map structure on the disk, which maps entire contiguous extents of on-disk disk blocks for a single file in just a few bytes in the indirection structures in the inode. That is all well and good until you start doing things like having holes in the files and then wanting to write into the middle of those holes. Once you do that, then you're having to shuffle around all of your extent maps and so on, and that gets really complicated. That's normally why people want B-trees for extent maps. If you're willing to forgo the ability to write into holes in your file system, you don't need B-trees for your extent maps. So that's something that we could do in EXT2 as an experiment to say, what's the minimal necessary modification to this file system to provide all of the benefits of extent maps, except for this facility with holes, which is going to be used by a vanishingly small fraction of users. We don't need to do B-tree directories. We can maybe do hashing of directories. A very much simpler extension to the file system, which can give us many of the performance improvements of B-tree directories, but without the implementation costs. So really, there are lots of these things that people are kind of looking at with EXT2. So EXT3 will be supported as a fully functional file system. It's not clear whether it will be ever merged into the official EXT2 source tree. I guess not, actually. But it's certainly not the only extension to EXT2 that's being talked about right now. Any questions? You've got 2.5 minutes. 2 minutes. One at the back. Yes, I know. No.
Okay, so that's one thing. You know it. I just want to publicly this.
In progress. Use a reserved line for the journal.
Okay.
Yeah, talked about that.
Second part is, when you create the journal, usually you do a DD. Okay? So
No, I told you that there's going to be a Tune 2FS option which does all that for you and puts it into reserve download. That'll all be invisible. Yes, sure, but
these... You can get around that by putting it on a different
journal. Yeah, there are actually a number of different issues there. First issue is that the journal writes are batched up into into a commit, say, every 5 or 10 seconds, and they're sequential. So there's only one seek to the journal and one seek from the journal for that operation. And the second thing is that because you're doing those updates into the journal, things like hot data, things like inodes which are constantly being updated or directories which are constantly being updated, are always hot in the journal, and they never have to be written back to disk. So you can actually eliminate the random seeks all over your main file system data because all the data is currently in the journal. So you're reducing the number of seeks in that case. And you can also put your journal in a separate disk entirely, if you want to. So it's experience with journaling file systems suggests this is not the problem that you think it will be. Obviously, it depends on the workload, but I'll take this offline. We've got a limited amount of time, and I should take questions from somebody else as well. Yep.
Do you, beyond the write boundary function you're talking about, do you anticipate other changes to the block driver interface?
Do I anticipate other changes to the block driver interface? Not right now. There are other changes going on, but they're not related to EXT3. In particular, there is work going on to replace the buffer head interface to the block device layer with a KIOBUF-based implementation. And that's going to be enormously more efficient. It will allow us to cleanly access high memory pages on large memory Intel boxes. It will allow us, if we get it right, to finally make the break and allow addressing of block devices larger than 2 terabytes. So yes, all that's going on, but it's not related to the EXT3 work. Yeah. What about crash during recovery? It doesn't matter. Recovery is idempotent. Recovery just consists of going through the log and writing what's in the log back to disk. And writing it back to disk twice is just as good as writing it once. So if you crash during the recovery, you've written half of the log, well, the next recovery goes along and just does exactly the same set of writes, plus a few more. And only when the recovery is completed do we ever make do we make the modification to the journal which marks recovery as being done. There are no modifications to the journal while recovery is in progress. So it just works. There's no problems there. Yeah. Does it at the moment work with software RAID? It will work with hardware RAID. It will work with software RAID once the 2.4 port is done because the bug in software RAID has been fixed in 2.4. It will not work with software RAID on 2.2. The reason for that is that software RAID, when it does RAID recovery after a crash, works by doing a buffer cache read of stripe by stripe through the whole disk, writing those stripes back. And when it writes those stripes back, it updates the disks which were not consistent at the time of the crash. Unfortunately, when it's doing that, it's causing contents of the buffer cache to be written to disk without the file system say-so, and therefore it's violating the write ordering requirements of the journaling file system. And EXT3 adds a whole pile of debugging code to the block device layer to detect violations of the write ordering requirements, because that's really good for debugging. You don't want these things to happen silently. Write ordering violations are really, really hard to detect, because the only way you'll detect them normally is by crashing and finding that something doesn't work right when you recover the file system, and you've got absolutely no idea what went wrong. So having those debugging entries in the ESCC code is really, really important to make sure that we detect write ordering violations when they happen, and the RAID devices violate the write ordering in recovery, not in 2.4, so they'll be fine in 2.4. There's a question over here somewhere? Nope. Okay, thank you very much then.